It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Wheeling theology student Michael Iafrate has been charged with writing an important pastoral letter.
The idea is to gather up those voices, to reflect on them through the social justice tradition, through scripture, of our various church traditions, and then to make a statement, but to lift those voices up so that we can then have further dialogue from a place of a faith commitment.
The story coming up on this West Virginia Morning. Last week, we focused on the constitutional balance of power in the state after controversy at the State House focused on the legislature's ability to override a veto by the governor. We turn from the executive and legislative branches to the judicial this morning as Ashton Mara speaks with two members of the state's judicial branch, who say a final decision on the matter could possibly be left to them.
It's safe to say members of the judicial branch have a more idyllic outlook on the balance of powers in West Virginia. At least, that's the sense you get after talking to two sitting members of the state's highest court, the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. Justice Brent Benjamin has sat on the court for 10 years now and just finished his second one-year term as Chief Justice, while Justice Alan Laufrey is the new kid on the block, so to speak, elected to his seat in 2012. Laufrey says this about the balance of power.
I think that the three separate branches play their role, and I think it works at making certain that no group or no individual has so much power. I think that the three branches work very well and protect the citizens.
Idyllic, right? Benjamin agrees. This system is the best in the world, he says. But when it comes to that tension built into our government's framework, a tension some have called natural and necessary, Benjamin says there tends to be more of a focus on the battles between executive and legislative leaders.
I think when the legislature and the governor have any tension at all, they view us and we view ourselves as the referees. That's what the Constitution pretty much sets our job as. And we take that very seriously.
He says that referee role became clear in 2010 when the Supreme Court was looked to for a ruling on the role of governor and how to fill the vacant position after Senator Robert Byrd passed away and then Governor Joe Manchin won the seat in a special election. The current tension is focused on the legislature's ability to override the governor's veto of the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, a bill that would ban abortions in the state after 20 weeks. Laufrey and Benjamin both say they will not discuss the legislation because, in Benjamin's words, it's an issue that could, quote, certainly come before them. Both Benjamin and Laufrey also make it quite clear that their roles in state government are meant to be nonpartisan and nonpolitical. But while they may feel that's how they perform their duties, that's not necessarily how they got there. West Virginia is one of few states in the nation that holds partisan elections for their judicial officers at all levels, from the Supreme Court justices down to county-level magistrates. That means everyone who holds a judicial office in the state got there by winning an election and doing so with an R or a D attached to their name on a ballot. And both men have interesting election stories to tell. In 2004, Benjamin, a Republican, ran against incumbent Justice Warren McGraw and was criticized not for personal campaign donations, but donations that went to a political action committee focused on pushing McGraw out of office, backed by then Massey CEO Don Blankenship. That PAC's message took the form of television advertising campaigns like this one.
Voted to release child rapist Tony Arbaugh from prison. Worse, McGraw agreed to let this convicted child rapist work as a janitor in a West Virginia school.
After a string of negative ads, Benjamin was able to defeat McGraw and went on to cast the deciding vote in favor of Blankenship in a case claiming Massey fraudulently canceled a coal supply contract with Harmon Mining, putting it out of business. Benjamin was criticized for not recusing himself from the case. But then there's Laufrey, also a Republican, whose campaign ads in 2012 sounded more like this one.
I'm Justice Laufrey. My dad is Alan Laufrey. He wants to be a justice too. But in this family, I'm the justice.
TV ads fronted by his son, Justice Laufrey, with a bowl cut and a few missing teeth. But Laufrey's campaign dollars came from an alternative source in West Virginia, a recently approved and newly extended public campaign finance option for Supreme Court races, providing hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to fund a race.
If you give a $1,000 donation to a governor right before he signs a bill, it's called a campaign contribution. If you give a $1,000 donation to a legislator right before a big vote, it's a campaign contribution. If you give me $1,000 right before I issue an opinion, well, that's a bribe. So for me, as someone running for office, I can't even ask someone for a political contribution. That is a huge difference between the other two branches of government. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, by the way, because I don't think judges should be able to go up to people and solicit contributions when they may have a case in front of the court.
In 2013, the legislature chose to extend the public campaign finance program through the 2016 election, and one of the seats up that year happens to belong to Justice Brent Benjamin. Benjamin says it's a bit early to make the decision, but called public campaign financing an option for his reelection bid, although he adds he understands the opposition to the program.
I think that while it's certainly good from one standpoint, there's a lot of people who say, why should I be forced as a taxpayer to fund somebody's campaign that I disagree with?
Benjamin also supports the idea of working to take the politics out of judicial elections in the state. Laufrey agrees, but adds it should not necessarily be done by changing to a merit system.
But I would rather put it in the hands of the voters of this state to choose their representatives, to choose their judges and their justices, than allowing one single governor to pick five justices on the Supreme Court, to pick 70 circuit judges, to pick 45 family court judges, to pick 158 magistrates. I think that also shows an additional separation between the two branches.
Laufrey says, however, a partisan election can sometimes help voters get a better feel for candidates they don't know much about. He also adds he won't be advocating for the legislature to change the partisan election system. It's their prerogative, he says, and it's not his place to tell lawmakers how to do their jobs. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
A Wheeling native who is a doctoral student of theology will be the lead author of a new pastoral letter in the works. Glennis Board spoke with him and brings us this report.
The Catholic Committee of Appalachia is a network of faith-based people with a mission to raise a prophetic voice for Appalachia and her people. It was born as an offshoot of Appalachian ecumenical efforts in the 1970s, which were engaged in the then-declared War on Poverty. Since then, the Catholic Committee of Appalachia has been concerned with social and environmental justice, issues such as mountaintop removal, labor, private prison development, community sustainability, poverty, health, clean water, racism, and climate change. Perhaps most notably, though, the committee published a couple of Appalachian bishops' pastoral letters. These are writings that are addressed by a bishop to Catholic clergy, laity, and the general public. Pastorals generally contain instruction, consolation, or direction for behavior in particular circumstances. The first one, in 1975, was entitled "This Land is Home to Me," a pastoral letter on the poverty and powerlessness in Appalachia. The second, published in 1995, was entitled "At Home in the Web of Life," a pastoral message on sustainable communities in Appalachia. According to the West Virginia Encyclopedia, "This Land is Home to Me" is recognized to be one of the most significant statements to emerge from the U.S. Catholic Church and has become a model for groups all over the world that are interested in writing on matters of social justice. More than 200,000 copies of the pastoral are in circulation, and it's been translated into several languages.
And it was a pretty revolutionary document in a lot of ways in the Catholic Church, which a lot of the documents that sort of embody the Catholic Church's teaching on social justice have really come from a top-down model. Well, this letter kind of was generated from below by the people themselves and then endorsed by the bishops.
Michael Iafrate is a doctoral student of theology from Wheeling. He's a board member of the Catholic Committee of Appalachia and the chair of the Pastoral Committee. Iafrate will also be the lead author of the third pastoral letter, which will likely be published in 2015. Interestingly, Iafrate is also a musician, a lyricist, and a songwriter. That fact is significant because previously the pastoral letters were written in a kind of free verse style of prose. Here's an excerpt from This Land is Home to Me. Appalachia makes us think of people who live in the hills, who love nature's freedom and beauty, who are alive with song and poetry. But many of these people are also poor and suffer oppression. Once they went to the mountains fighting to build a dream different from the injustice they knew before. Until this day, their struggle continues, a bitter fight whose sound still rumbles across the hills.
Unlike the first two, is not going to end up being a Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter. This one's going to be what we call a people's pastoral, which pushes the methodology of the first two a little bit further in that really we're looking to amplify the voices of the people and really their legitimate teaching authority to the rest of the church, the rest of the region, and the rest of the world.
The previous pastoral letters were written by lay people and then endorsed by some 25 Catholic bishops throughout Appalachia. Iafrate says he isn't sure if next year's letters will be similarly endorsed. Iafrate says that the methodology in the past has been to listen to communities speak their concerns and hopes for the future. In that vein, the Catholic Committee is conducting listening sessions.
We've been holding gatherings of people in various communities throughout the region to listen to people's stories of not only their struggles, but their ideas for how things can change.
Iafrate points to the recent Kanawha Valley water crisis and various meetings surrounding issues of the chemical spill that tainted drinking water for 300,000 West Virginia residents. He says it was an opportunity to hear not only about that incident, but also of a wider water quality concern that's spread across the region.
The idea is to gather up those voices, to reflect on them through the social justice tradition, through scripture, of our various church traditions, and then to make a statement, but to lift those voices up so that we can then have further dialogue from a place of a faith commitment.
Iafrate says his committee is working to address blind spots in previous listening sessions.
Another group that we've been very intentional about listening to, and I think this is pretty unique in Catholic circles at least, is that we're listening with intentionality to the voices of gay and lesbian people of faith.
The Catholic Committee is also just reaching out broadly for insights into today's Appalachian condition with online tools, including a survey that asks questions such as, what is your story of struggle? How would things be different if you had no fear or obstacles? And where is there hope in your situation right now? For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:43. Mostly sunny and pleasant today. Highs ranging from near 70 in the northern panhandle to near 80 in the southwest. Becoming mostly cloudy overnight with a chance of rain after midnight, lows in the upper 40s and 50s. And there's a 50-50 chance of rain and thunderstorms tomorrow. Temperatures only in the 60s, clearing skies Tuesday night. Sunshine returns on Wednesday, a little cooler, with daytime highs reaching the 50s on Wednesday.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
Columnaris disease. It's an illness affecting aquatic life in West Virginia. While it can be fatal, Division of Natural Resources officials are trying to stop it from spreading to more waters in the state. Beneduccio reports.
Columnaris disease affects fish, creating lesions in them. It's caused by stress. It acts like a rash, causing an itchy sensation on the fish, and if untreated, the fish can quickly die from the illness. The disease came to West Virginia a few years ago. It caused a fish kill in Stonewall Jackson Lake in 2010, killing more than 1,000 fish. It's since spread to different bodies of water, and DNR officials are working to make sure it doesn't get worse. Chris O'Bara is a fisheries biologist with the DNR.
This time of year, we have colonaris outbreaks, primarily because water temperatures are rising. And so fish get stressed as water temperatures rising. There's other ways that fish can get stressed. Low dissolved oxygen in the water, there's crowding, handling in our hatchery systems, we have to be careful.
The big reason why the disease spreads is because the illness acts like any kind of contagious disease. Fish can easily spread it from one to another if one rubs against a fish with the disease. Last year, the DNR saw more outbreaks.
And usually when you see outbreaks of a colinaris, you see it not just, you see it on a regional-wide basis. And I know we talked to some of the biologists in Pennsylvania, and they were having similar type outbreaks. And so it was more of a regional thing that we were seeing with the outbreaks of the disease. And again, it was probably tied to a link to something that was something in the natural environment that we saw that just, you know, was very hard for us to pick up. But those fish really were stressed out at a certain time, and the bacteria were present, and with stress and bacteria, those get together and we have a disease issue.
O'Bara says colinaris disease could be an even greater threat to the state's waters in years to come. He says this is primarily due to warmer temperatures in the summer months.
As water temperature changes or increases in climate change, we're going to see a new series of pathogens, you know, invading these areas and the old ones kind of not being there anymore. So some of the pathogens that were probably linked to cold water, we probably won't see as many of those, and some of the newer pathogens that are moving in that we'll see to warmer water.
But there's good news. O'Bara says states throughout the northeastern part of the country are placing more resources on how to treat this disease and other diseases. And he says that due to technological developments, it's getting easier and easier for the DNR to attack this issue head on.
It's a lot easier to test things. So we have the testing. We have people that are trained that can look at something and say, there's a problem right here. So we're seeing more fish diseases, primarily by, you know, one of the aspects I'm sure is because we're better trained.
But what about fish that already have the disease? What should a person do if they think the fish they are eating may have it?
There is no link. And most fish diseases are like that. If you properly prepare the fish, there is no, we have never seen a link between diseases that affect fish or the pathogens that affect fish in human consumption of those fish. Now, I would personally not necessarily eat a fish that I saw a lesion on or something like that, just because it wouldn't be sightly and, you know, wouldn't be appetizing, I guess you would say. So, you know, my advice would be to people not to worry about if a fish looks healthy and then they decide to, you know, want to eat that fish, the disease aspect is not going to be a problem.
The DNR recommends for people who transport fish to be wary of keeping possibly affected fish with others. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Chuck Anzalevich. I'm Beth Voorhees.